Chapter 3. Geishas. I descended the steps. The sedan stopped in front of the doorway. It idled there for a moment and then inched forward, its occupant apparently not liking what he saw or not finding the person he sought. I tried to peer through the car's windows but found only the reflection of the restaurant's neon sign. Suddenly the driver gunned the engine and sped away. When I reached the restaurant, its interior was obscured by thin curtains. I pressed my face against the glass. It was dark inside, except for small globes of flickering light that I took for candles. I stepped to the door. It opened into a darkened room with a lantern on each of a dozen or so tables. A quick survey of the ones where guests were seated suggested cultural diversity. There were Asians and Europeans or Americans. A Chinese lady bowed to me. "Welcome," she said. "Good evening. Dinner for one?" Her accent suggested she had studied with a British teacher. She led me into the room. I froze, disbelieving what I saw. The woman from the pool, my lady, the person I had tried so hard to locate, sat at a table with another Asian woman staring back at me. Then she smiled and beckoned. The hostess observing her led me to her table. "Friends?" "Yes." The woman from the pool did not hesitate. "Will you join us, please?" The hostess pulled out an empty chair, bowed again, and walked away. I was reeling with confusion. "Where's your husband?" I asked. The two women exchanged glances and broke into laughter. "I'm not married," she said at last. "But the man at the pool?" "A business associate." Stifling a giggle, she indicated the chair. "Please have a seat. We just ordered more than enough for all of us, at least to begin. Or are you determined to dine alone?" Her English was close to perfect, with just the hint of an accent. I sat down. One part of me could not believe my good fortune. Another felt apprehensive, as though I were involving myself in something illicit. A waiter came over and set a small cup in front of me. The lady from the pool pointed at a little porcelain pot.
"Sake?"
"We have been drinking lots. This is our night to let go. Very good sake here." She filled my cup.
"Cheers."
Our three cups clinked.
"Oh, yes," she said, wiping her lips with a white linen napkin. "How rude. I'm Nancy, and this is Mary."
"John." I shook hands with each.
"I've observed you at the pool, John. I waited for you to come say hello. You seem very lonely and nice, but I think you're terribly shy. Or perhaps,"
she leaned toward me so close I could smell the liquor on her breath,
"you're madly in love with a wife."
It was my turn to laugh. "Getting divorced."
"In luck," Mary said. "Here's to broken marriages."
She raised her glass. She spoke with a similar accent, a bit heavier than Nancy's. The waiter arrived with several heaping plates of food. As we ate, we exchanged information about our backgrounds. Nancy and Mary shocked me when they described themselves as geishas. I admitted that I thought those days were long gone. They assured me that I was mistaken.
"Oil," Mary said, "revived this ancient art. Different, yes, but it's alive and well today."
Their pregnant Taiwanese mothers were abandoned by their fathers, American army officers assigned to their country after World War II. The women turned their newborn daughters over to a Japanese businessman. He arranged for foster care and their schooling, which included extensive lessons in English as well as in U.S. history and culture. When they reached maturity, they went to work for him.
"You've probably seen the women on the street out there."
Nancy pointed toward the pedestrian bridge outside the curtained window.
"That could be us. We're lucky."
She went on to say that the Japanese businessman paid them well and seldom dictated how they should act or specified what they should do.
"He asks for results, that's all. Up to us how we get them."
She poured us each more sake. "What sort of results?"
"How naive," Mary said. "He must be new here." I admitted that it was my first trip, my initial assignment, adding that I was eager to learn.
"We're happy to teach you," Nancy proclaimed. "You're a gem in our world. But we may ask for something in return. Not tonight, but sometime."
"At your service." I tried to appear nonchalant. They sounded more like college professors than geishas as they explained that men in power have always been willing to spend fortunes and sacrifice the lives of others in order to amass resources and power. I was amazed at their frankness and attributed it, at least in part, to the sake, although everything they said made absolute sense. They talked about the importance of the spice trade in the time of the great European explorers, and of the role gold had played for centuries.
"Today it's oil," Nancy continued. "The most precious resource ever. Everything depends on it. Spices and gold were luxuries without much real value. Good to taste, used as a preservative for jewelry and artifacts, but oil? Oil's life itself. Nothing in the modern world works without it. This is the biggest resource grab in history. The stakes are huge. Should we be surprised that men are willing to risk everything to control it? They'll cheat and steal, build ships and missiles, and send thousands, hundreds of thousands of young soldiers to die for oil."
"Is that what you learned in the history books?" She gave me a smirk.
"Of course not. That came from the school of hard knocks."
"Hard knocks?" Mary was beside herself with laughter.
"I can't believe you said that, Nance. That's perfect. I got to remember it. Hard knocks."
She shook her head. But I was thinking about Charlie and the speech he had given that first night at the restaurant on top of the Hotel Intercontinental about how we had come to Indonesia to save it from communists and secure oil for the United States. Then my thoughts turned to Claudine, the woman in Boston who had mentored me as an EHM. It occurred to me that she was part of the same tradition as these two Asian American women. I had to wonder if she ever thought of herself as a geisha. My eyes went from the laughing Mary to Nancy, and in that moment I saw Claudine and realized how much I missed her. I wondered whether my infatuation with the woman across the table, my poolside obsession, had grown out of my loneliness and perhaps a subconscious connection I had made between her and Claudine. I forced myself back to the present. Mary was wiping the laughter from her eyes with her napkin. I spoke to Nancy. "And you? What's your role?"
"We're like those soldiers, expendable but necessary. We serve the Emperor."
"Who is the Emperor?" Nancy shot a look at Mary.
"We never know. Whoever pays the highest price to our boss."
"The man at the pool?"
"He's my contact here, not the real boss. He takes me to my clients."
"In the Hotel Intercontinental?"
"Honeymoon suite."
She giggled but stopped herself. "Sorry. Mary and I always say that sometime we want a real honeymoon in that suite." She glanced away toward the curtained window. I recalled the black sedan that had cruised by, wondering if its occupant had been looking for one of them. "Only there, your work, the Hotel Indonesia?"
"Of course not. Country clubs, cruise ships, Hong Kong, Hollywood, Las Vegas, you name it. If oil men and politicians like it, we've been there."
My eyes roamed from one to the other. They seemed so young and so worldly. I was 26. I knew from their stories that they were about 5 years my junior. "Who are your clients?" Nancy lifted a finger to her lips. She glanced around the restaurant like a doe I had seen in a New Hampshire field, terrified by a dog barking in the distance.
"Never," she said, and her voice took on a solemn quality. "Ask that question."
Chapter 4. The Boogeyman. I returned to Indonesia frequently during the next few years. The World Bank, its affiliates, and the Suharto government appreciated Mainz's willingness to provide reports necessary for securing huge loans that would benefit U.S. corporations and the Indonesian rulers. They did not care that these loans would leave the country deeply indebted. For the banks, that was part of the plan. As far as Suharto was concerned,
By investing his mushrooming fortune overseas, he sheltered himself against the future of a bankrupt Indonesia. Over the years, my assignments took me to idyllic villages in the mountains of Java, remote beaches along the coasts, and exotic islands. The language, Bahasa Indonesia, was invented by linguists after World War II to help unite the islands. Its simplicity enabled me to learn the basics quickly. I enjoyed exploring areas seldom visited by foreigners, talking with the people, and trying to understand their culture. My Peace Corps training had taught me the value of departing from the paths traveled by most businessmen, diplomats, and tourists, of meeting farmers, fishermen, students, shop owners, and street urchins. Yet, it also assured that I would continue to be haunted by the guilt I felt over the terrible impact men like me had on the majority of Indonesia's people. When in Jakarta, I spent as much time as possible at the Hotel Intercontinental Indonesia swimming pool. I was disappointed that I never again saw either Nancy or Mary. However, I frequently observed their counterparts at work around the pool. I became intimate with one of them, a young Thai woman, and discovered that the use of geishas was not restricted to the Japanese. We Americans had our own version, as did the Europeans and other Asians. However, it seemed a consensus among these women that the Japanese were the ideal employers, and that they had perfected this profession in a manner unequaled by other cultures. Appropriate, I thought, given their long history. The Thai woman befriended me not to gain anything, or because someone had hired her to compromise me. After all, I had already been bought. She did it either from the goodness in her heart, because she needed someone like me in her life, or perhaps due to the chemistry that passed between us. I was never entirely sure of her motives, only that she was a companion, erotic inspiration, and confidant. She also enlightened me about the ways of high-level international business and diplomacy.
"Expect hidden cameras and tape recorders in the rooms of ladies who try to seduce you," she said, quickly adding with a smile, "Not that you're unattractive, just that things aren't as they appear."
She taught me that women like her played a pivotal role in shaping some of the world's most important deals. A couple of years after my first assignment, I was sent for 3 months to Sulawesi, the remote island east of Borneo. Known affectionately as the Running Drunken Giraffe because of its shape on maps, this island was singled out to serve as a model for rural development. Once an important part of the East India spice trade, it became a 20th century backwater. Now the Indonesian government was determined to make it a symbol of progress. We Americans saw it as a potential cash cow for mineral, forestry, and agricultural industries. Several mammoth corporations coveted its gold and copper potentials and its exotic trees. A large Texas ranch had bought thousands of acres of forests, cleared and sold them, and planned on shipping beef in football field-sized barges to the lucrative Singapore and Hong Kong markets. Sulawesi was also viewed as a cornerstone of the government's transmigration program, a scheme similar to the colonization of the Amazon that had impacted the people I worked with during my Peace Corps years, aimed at moving the urban poor from cities in Java, which had the highest population density in the world, to underpopulated areas. Like its Latin American version, this program was supported by the international development agencies as a method for dispersing impoverished slum dwellers to unsettled rural regions and thereby mitigating against the likelihood of anti-government rebellions. The policy continued despite the fact that experts soon discovered that on both continents, such programs often turned disastrous. Local indigenous people were displaced, their lands and cultures destroyed, while newly transplanted urban populations struggled unsuccessfully to cultivate the fragile soil. When I arrived in Sulawesi, I was given a government-owned house outside the old Portuguese city of Makassar, renamed Ujung Pandang in one of Suharto's nods at nationalism, complete with maid, gardener, chef, jeep, and driver. My job, as usual, was to travel to any region that appeared to have resources multinational corporations might exploit, meet with community leaders, collect all available information, and write a glowing report proving that huge loans to develop electric power and other infrastructure projects would turn this medieval economy into a modern success. A town known as Batesville, located near the budding Texas cattle ranch, had been identified as a possible location for a power plant. Early one morning, my driver drove us out of Ujung Pandang up the spectacular coast to the port city of Parapara. From there, we wound cautiously into the mountains of the remote interior, the road barely more than a dirt trail cut through jungle. I felt like I had returned to the Amazon. When the jeep pulled into the village of Pinrang, the driver announced, "This is it, Batesville." I glanced around. The name of the village had piqued my interest. I searched for the bats, but saw nothing unusual. The driver cruised slowly past a plaza that resembled many others in towns throughout Indonesia. It had a couple of benches and several trees with huge dark clusters hanging from their branches, like extra-large coconuts. Then suddenly one of those clusters opened up. My heart caught in my throat as I realized that a gigantic bat was stretching her wings. The driver pulled to a stop. He led me to a spot beneath one of the bats. The amazing animal was moving above us, her wings sluggishly uncoiling her body as large as a monkey. The eyes opened. The head turned and stared at us. I had heard rumors that these bats shorted out electric lines, indicating that their wingspans measured in excess of 6 feet. However, even in my wildest imagination, I had never expected anything to compare with what I was seeing. Later, I met with the mayor of Pinrang. I quizzed him about local resources and likely attitudes toward building a power plant and industries owned by foreigners in his area. But the bats dominated my thoughts. When I asked whether they caused problems, he replied, "No, they fly away every evening and eat fruit far out of town. They return mornings, never touch our fruit." He raised his teacup. "Very much like your corporations," he said with a sly smile. "They fly off, feed on resources far away, defecate on lands people from the United States will never visit, and then return to you." I heard this theme often. I had begun to understand that although most Americans have no idea that their lifestyles are built on exploitation, millions of people in other countries are aware of it. Even in the 1970s, they viewed our military not as a defender of democracy, but rather as an armed guard for exploitative corporations, and they were frightened and angry as a result. Sulawesi was also the home of the infamous Bugi tribe. European spice traders centuries ago feared them as the fiercest, most bloodthirsty pirates in the world. When they returned home, the Europeans threatened disobedient children with the warning that, if they did not change their ways, the boogeymen will get you. During the 1970s, the boogies continued to live much as they had for hundreds of years. Their magnificent sailing ships, called praus, formed the backbone of inter-island commerce. The sailors who manned these black-sailed galleons wore long sarongs, brilliantly colored headscarves, and dazzling gold earrings. They carried vicious machetes thrust through sashes at their waists. They looked as though they still cherished their ancient reputation. I became friends with an elder named Buli, a shipbuilder who practiced his art in the manner of his ancestors. One day, when he and I were lunching together, he observed that his people never saw themselves as pirates. They were merely defending their homeland against intruders. "Now," he said, handing me a slice of a luscious fruit, "we're at a loss. How can a handful of people in wooden sailing ships fight off America's submarines, airplanes, bombs, and missiles?" Questions like that got to me. Eventually, they convinced me to change my ways. Chapter 5. A Corrupt and Brutal Country. Years after my conversation with the Buginese shipbuilder, I ended my EHM career. The decision to do so, as described in Confessions, was made while on a sailing vacation among Caribbean islands that once were strongholds for pirates who plundered Spain's gold fleet. Late one afternoon, sitting on the ruined walls of an ancient sugar plantation, contemplating the horrors experienced by the African slaves who constructed those buildings, I understood that I too was a slaver. following years of emotional turmoil, I made up my mind to get out. I flew back to Boston and quit. But I did not expose the horrible facts behind this new empire. I succumbed to threats and bribes. I deferred. And during the ensuing years, my past haunted me. I had to live with what I had done and what I knew. Then, shortly after 9/11, standing at the edge of that horrible smoldering pit that had once been the World Trade Center, I knew that at last I had to step forward. I had to confess. After the publication of Confessions of an Economic Hitman in 2004, as I began to field questions from radio interviewers, I realized that I understood little about the ways my actions as an EHM impacted the countries where I had worked. We had defeated the Soviet Union and emerged as the world's first truly global empire, unchallenged by any other superpower. We bragged about progress and industrialization. We had created a new class of third world elites, the lackeys of the corporatocracy. But what about the majority of the people in the places we had subjugated? I decided to update myself, beginning with the country where I had started my career. I had kept abreast of general events in Indonesia through the mainstream media. Now I began to dig deeper, researching information that was available from non-governmental organizations, NGOs, and academics, as well as from the United Nations, the World Bank, and the other organizations I once had served. My curiosity deepened as I became more familiar with the circumstances surrounding the 1997 Asian economic collapse, also known as the IMF crisis. This debacle began in Asia, where it impacted hundreds of millions of people and resulted in thousands, possibly millions, of deaths from disease, starvation, and suicides, and then spread across the globe. For those willing to listen, it sent a strong message about the true intent of the IMF and the World Bank, a lesson in how not to manage an economy unless the goal is to further enrich the corporatocracy at the expense of everyone else. On first glance, the official statistics indicated that our work in the 1970s in Indonesia had produced an admirable economic record, at least until 1997. Those statistics bragged of low inflation, foreign exchange reserves totaling more than $20 billion, a trade surplus of more than $900 million, and a solid banking sector. Indonesia's economic growth, measured by GDP, averaged nearly 9% every year in the 1990s until 1997. Not as spectacular as the double-digit forecasts I had been paid to produce, but highly impressive nevertheless. Economists at the World Bank, IMF, consulting firms, and academic institutions used such statistics to argue that the development policies promoted by us EHMs had proven successful. I soon ascertained, however, that the statistics did not address the extremely high price the Indonesian people had paid for what the economists referred to as an economic miracle. The benefits were restricted to those at the top of the economic ladder. Rapid advances in national income were achieved through the abuse of cheap and plentiful labor, in sweatshops where workers endured long hours and suffered life-threatening conditions, and with policies granting foreign corporations licenses to destroy the environment and conduct activities that were outlawed in North America and the rest of the First World. Although the minimum wage rose to around $3 a day, it was often ignored. In 2002, an estimated 52% of Indonesia's population lived on less than $2 a day, which from most perspectives is comparable to modern-day slavery. Even $3 a day was not sufficient to provide basic amenities to many of the workers and their families. It is no coincidence that Indonesia acquiesced to policies that so burdened her people. The horrendous debts incurred to amass fortunes for the country's elites left it no choice. According to the Global Development Finance Report of the World Bank and IMF-IFS, IMF's International Financial Statistics, the country consistently averaged the highest foreign debt as a percentage of gross domestic product, or GDP, of all Asian countries. During the critical 1990-96 period that ushered in the 1997 Asian collapse, this number hovered around or above 60%, compared to about 35% for Thailand, 15% for both China and Hong Kong, and 10% for Singapore and Taiwan. Its debt service plus short-term debt as a percentage of foreign reserves averaged close to a whopping 300% during the 1990-96 period, compared to about 120% for Thailand, 60% for China, and 25% for Hong Kong and Taiwan. This figure not available for Singapore. It was clear that we had burdened this country with such staggering amounts of debt that it could not possibly repay them. Indonesians were forced to redeem themselves by satisfying the desires of our corporations. We EHMs had achieved our objective. Once again, national economic yardsticks had proven highly deceptive. As is so often the case, in Indonesia, the glowing foreign exchange, favorable trade balance, low inflation, and impressive GDP growth figures described the condition of a small, wealthy segment of the population. Everyone else lived outside the mainstream, measurable economy. They carried a terrible burden. Perhaps nowhere is the connection between poverty, corporate abuses, and the U.S. consumer more apparent than in Indonesian sweatshops, which are typical of those in many other countries. Major international corporations, supported by World Bank and IMF policies that encourage privatization and tax relief for foreign companies, either own factories or contract out to ones where human beings are grossly underpaid and, if they protest, are beaten or killed. They suffer horrible lives so that merchandise can be sold at low prices in first world stores. People approached me as I traveled around the United States on my book tour for Confessions to tell me that companies like Nike, Adidas, Ralph Lauren, Walmart, and The Gap were benefiting from what amounted to slave labor. One intrepid couple offered a particularly disturbing account based on their own shocking personal experiences in Indonesia.